you could issue two classes of stock, Class A and Class B. The public would get Class B's, which would carry one vote per share. The founders and Inner Circle and your convertible debenture holders would get Class A's, which would entitle them to name three-quarters of the board of directors. In other words, you raise enormous sums of money, turbocharge your growth, but ensure that you keep control. I looked at him dumbstruck. Can we really do that? It's not easy, but the New York Times and the Washington Post and a couple of others have done it. I think you can do it. Maybe it wasn't Satori or Kensho, but it was instant enlightenment. In a flash. The breakthrough I'd been seeking for years. Chuck, I said, that sounds like the answer. At the next butt face, I explained the concept of Class A and Class B, and everyone had the same reaction, at long last. But I cautioned the butt faces. Whether or not this was the solution, we needed to do something, right now, fix our cash flow problem once and for all, because our window was closing. I could suddenly see a recession on the horizon. 6 months, a year at the max. If we waited, tried to go public then, the market would give us far less than we were worth. I asked for a show of hands. Going public, all in favor? It was unanimous. The moment we resolved our long-standing Cold War with our competitors and the feds, we would initiate a public offering. The spring flowers were up by the time our lawyers and government officials had settled on a number, $9 million. It still sounded way too high, but everyone told me to pay it. Take the deal, they kept saying. I spent an hour staring out my window, mulling. The flowers in the calendar said it was spring, but that day the clouds were eye level, dishwater gray, and the world was cold. I groaned. I grabbed the phone and dialed Warshkol, who had taken the role of lead negotiator. Let's do it. I told Carol Fields to cut the check. She brought it to me for my signature. We looked at each other, and of course, we were both thinking about the time I'd written that check for $1 million, which I couldn't cover. Now I was writing a check for $9 million, and there was no way it was going to bounce. I looked at the signature line. $9 million, I whispered. I could still remember selling my 1960 MG with racing tires and a twin cam for $1,100. Like yesterday. Lead me from the unreal to the real. The letter arrived at the start of summer. The Chinese government requests the pleasure of a visit. I spent a month deciding who would go. It has to be the A-team, I thought. So I sat with a yellow legal pad in my lap, making lists of names, scratching them out, making new lists. Chang, of course. Strasser, naturally. Hayes, surely. I notified everyone who was going on the trip to get their papers and passports and affairs in order. Then I spent the days leading up to our departure reading, cramming on Chinese history, the Boxer Rebellion, the Great Wall, Opium Wars, Ming Dynasty, Confucius, Mao. And darned if I was going to be the only student. I made a syllabus for all members of our traveling party. In July 1980, we boarded a plane. Beijing, here we come. But I thought it would be a good idea to stop along the way. Tokyo, just to check in. Sales were starting to grow again in the Japanese market. Also, Japan would be a nice way to ease everyone into China, which was going to be a challenge for all of us. Baby steps. Penny and Gorman, I'd learned my lesson. 12 hours later, walking the streets of Tokyo, alone, my mind kept spinning back to 1962. My crazy idea. Now I was back, on the verge of taking that idea to the next level, possibly into a mammoth new market. I thought of Marco Polo. I thought of Confucius. But I also thought of all the games I'd seen through the years. Football, basketball, baseball. When one team had a big lead in the final seconds or innings and relaxed, or tightened and therefore lost. I told myself to stop looking back, keep my gaze forward. We ate a few wonderful Japanese dinners and visited a few old friends. And after 2 or 3 days, rested and ready, we were all set to go. Our flight to Beijing was the next morning. We had one last meal together in the Ginza, washed down with several cocktails, and everyone turned in early. I took a hot shower, phoned home, and poured myself into bed. A few hours later, I woke to frantic knocking. I looked at the clock on the nightstand. 2 a.m. "Who's there?" I moaned. "David Chang, let me in." I went to the door and found Chang looking very un-Chang, rumpled, harried, regimental tie askew. "Hayes isn't going," he said.
"What are you talking about?"
"Hayes is downstairs in the bar, and he says he can't do it. He cannot get on that plane."
"Why not?"
"He's having some kind of panic attack."
"Yes, he has phobias."
"What kind of phobias?"
"He has all the phobias."
I started to get dressed to go down to the bar. Then I remembered who it was we were dealing with.
"Go to bed," I said to Chang. "Hayes will be there in the morning."
"But..."
"He'll be there."
First thing in the morning, dull-eyed, deathly pale, Hayes was standing in the lobby. Of course he made sure to pack enough medicine for his next attack. Hours later, going through customs in Beijing, I heard behind me a great commotion. The room was bare, with plywood partitions, and on the other side of one partition, several Chinese officers were shouting. I went around the partition and found two officers, agitated, pointing at Hayes and his open suitcase. I walked over. Strasser and Chang walked over. Lying atop Hayes' giant underwear were 12 quarts of vodka. No one said anything for the longest time. Finally, Hayes broke the silence. "That's for me," he said. "You guys are on your own." Over the next 12 days, we traveled all over China in the company of government handlers. They took us to Tiananmen Square and made sure we stopped a long time in front of the giant portrait of Chairman Mao, who had died 4 years earlier. They took us to the Forbidden City. They took us to the Ming Tombs. We were fascinated, of course, and curious, too curious. We made our handlers excruciatingly uncomfortable with all our questions. At one stop, I looked around and saw hundreds of people in Mao suits and flimsy black shoes, which seemed made of construction paper. But a few children were wearing canvas sneakers. That gave me hope. What we wanted to see, of course, were factories. Our handlers reluctantly agreed. They took us by train to remote towns, far from Beijing, where we saw vast and terrifying industrial complexes. Small metropolises of factories, each one more outdated than the last. Old, rusted, decrepit. These factories made Hayes' ancient Sako ruin look state-of-the-art. Above all, they were filthy. A shoe would roll off the assembly line with a stain, a swath of grime, and nothing would be done. There was no overarching sense of cleanliness, no real quality control. When we pointed out a defective shoe, the officials running the factories would shrug and say, "Perfectly functional." Never mind aesthetics. The Chinese didn't see why the nylon or canvas in a pair of shoes needed to be the same shade in the left shoe and the right. It was common practice for a left shoe to be light blue and a right shoe to be dark blue. We met with scores of factory officials and local politicians and assorted dignitaries. We were toasted, feted, queried, monitored, talked at, and almost always welcomed warmly. We ate pounds of sea urchin and roasted duck, and at many stops we were treated to thousand-year-old eggs. I could taste every one of those 1,000 years. Of course, we were served many Mao Tais. After all my trips to Taiwan, I was prepared. My liver was seasoned. What I wasn't prepared for was how much Hayes would like the taste. With each sip, he smacked his lips and asked for more. Near the end of our visit, we took a 19-hour train ride to Shanghai. We could have flown, but I insisted on the train. I wanted to see, to experience the countryside. Within the first hour, the men were cursing me. The day was dripping hot, and the train was not air-conditioned. There was one old fan in the corner of our train car, the blades barely moving the hot dust around.
To get cool, Chinese passengers thought nothing of stripping down to their underwear, and Hayes and Strasser thought this gave them license to do the same. If I live to be 200 years old, I won't forget the sight of those leviathans walking up and down the train car in their T-shirts and BVDs. Nor will any Chinese man or woman who was on the train that day. Before leaving China, we had a final errand or two in Shanghai. The first was to secure a deal with the Chinese Track and Field Federation. This meant securing a deal with the government's Ministry of Sports. Unlike the Western world, where every athlete made his own deal, China itself negotiated endorsement deals for all its athletes. So, in an old Shanghai schoolhouse, in a classroom with 75-year-old furniture and a huge portrait of Chairman Mao, Strasser and I met with the ministry representative. The first several minutes, the representative lectured us on the beauties of communism. He kept saying that the Chinese like to do business with like-minded people. Strasser and I looked at each other. Like-minded? What gives? Then the lecturer abruptly stopped. The representative leaned forward, and in a low voice that struck me as a Chinese version of Uber agent Lee Steinberg, he asked, "How much you offering?" Within 2 hours, we had ourselves a deal. 4 years later, in Los Angeles, the Chinese track and field team would walk into an Olympic stadium for the first time in nearly two generations wearing American shoes and warm-ups. Nike shoes and warm-ups. Our final meeting was with the Ministry of Foreign Trade. As with all previous meetings, there were several rounds of long speeches, mainly by officials. Hayes was bored during the first round. By the third round, he was suicidal. He started playing with the loose threads on the front of his polyester dress shirt. Suddenly, he became annoyed with the threads. He took out his lighter. As the Deputy Minister of Foreign Trade was hailing us as worthy partners, he stopped and looked up to see that Hayes had set himself on fire. Hayes beat on the flame with his hands and managed to put it out, but only after ruining the moment and the speaker's mojo. It didn't matter. Just before getting on the plane home, we signed deals with two Chinese factories and officially became the first American shoemaker in 25 years to be allowed to do business in China. It seems wrong to call it business. It seems wrong to throw all those hectic days and sleepless nights, all those magnificent triumphs and desperate struggles under that bland generic banner, business. What we were doing felt like so much more. Each new day brought 50 new problems, 50 tough decisions that needed to be made right now, and we were always on red alert, acutely aware that one rash move, one wrong decision could be the end. The margin for error was forever getting narrower, while the stakes were forever creeping higher, and none of us wavered in the belief that stakes didn't mean money. For some, I realized business is the all-out pursuit of profits, period, full stop. But for us, business was no more about making money than being human is about making blood. Yes, the human body needs blood. It needs to manufacture red and white cells and platelets and redistribute them evenly, smoothly to all the right places, on time, or else. But that day-to-day business of the human body isn't our mission as human beings. It's a basic process that enables our higher aims. And life always strives to transcend the basic processes of living. And at some point, in the late 1970s, I did too. I redefined winning, expanded it beyond my original definition of not losing, of merely staying alive. That was no longer enough to sustain me or my company. We wanted, as all great businesses do, to create, to contribute, and we dare to say so aloud. When you make something, when you improve something, when you deliver something, when you add some new thing or service to the lives of strangers, making them happier or healthier or safer or better, and when you do it all crisply and efficiently, smartly, the way everything should be done but so seldom is, you're participating more fully in the whole vast human drama. More than simply alive, you're helping others to live more fully. And if that's business, all right, call me a businessman. Maybe it will grow on me. There was no time to unpack. There was no time to get over our post-China jet lag, which was profound. As we returned to Oregon, the process of going public was in full swing. Big choices needed to be made, especially who was going to manage the offering. Public offerings don't always succeed. On the contrary, when mismanaged, they turn into train wrecks. So this was a critical decision right out of the blocks. Chuck, having worked at Kuhn, Loeb, still had strong relationships with their people and thought they'd be best. We interviewed four or five other firms, but in the end decided to go with Chuck's instincts. He hadn't steered us wrong yet. Next, we had to create a prospectus. It took 50 drafts at least to get it looking and sounding the way we wanted. Finally, at the tail end of summer, we handed all our paperwork to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And at the start of September, we released the formal announcement. Nike will be creating 20 million shares of Class A stock and 30 million shares of Class B. The price of the stock, we told the world, would be somewhere between $18 and $22 a share, TBD. Of 50 million shares total, almost 30 million would be held in reserve, and about 2 million Class Bs would be sold to the public. Of the remaining 17 million Class A shares, the pre-existing shareholders, or insiders, meaning me, Bowerman, the debenture holders, and the buttfaces, would own 56%. I personally would own about 46%. It needed to be that much, we all agreed, because the company needed to be run by one person, to speak with one firm and steady voice, come what may. There could be no chance of alliances or breakaway factions, no existential struggles for control. To the outsider, the division of shares might have seemed disproportionate, unbalanced, unfair. To the buttfaces, it was a necessity. There wasn't a word of dissent or complaint, ever. We hit the road. Days before the offering, we went out to sell potential investors on the worthiness of our product, our company, our brand, ourselves. After China, we weren't in any mood to travel, but there was no other way. We had to do what Wall Street calls a dog and pony show. 12 cities, 7 days. First stop, Manhattan. Breakfast meeting with a room full of hard-eyed bankers who represented thousands of potential investors. Hayes rose first and said a few introductory words. He summed up the numbers succinctly. He was quite good. Forceful. Sober. Johnson then stood and spoke about the shoes themselves, what made them different and special, how they'd come to be so innovative. He was never better. I closed. I talked about the company's origins, its soul and spirit. I had a note card with a few words scribbled on it, but I didn't look at it once. I had no uncertainty about what I wanted to say. I'm not sure I could have explained myself to a room full of strangers, but I had no trouble explaining Nike. I started with Bowerman. I talked about running for him at Oregon, then forming a partnership with him as a kid in my mid-20s. I talked about his brains, his bravery, his magic waffle iron. I talked about his booby-trapped mailbox. It was a funny story, and it never failed to get a laugh, but it had a point. I wanted to let these New Yorkers know that though we hailed from Oregon, we were not to be trifled with. The cowards never started, and the weak died along the way. That leaves us, ladies and gentlemen, us. That first night we gave the same presentation at a formal dinner in Midtown before twice as many bankers. Cocktails were served beforehand. Hayes had one too many. This time, when he stood to speak, he decided to improvise, to freestyle. "I've been around these guys a long time," he said, laughing. "The core of the company, you might say. And I'm here to tell you, they're all chronic unemployables." Dry coughs. A throat in the back was cleared. A lone cricket chirped, then died. Somewhere, far off, one person laughed like a loon. To this day, I think it was Johnson. Money was no laughing matter to these people, and a public offering of this size was not the occasion for jokes. I sighed, looked down at my note card. If Hayes had driven a bulldozer through the room, it could hardly have been worse. Later that night, I took him aside and told him I thought it was best if he didn't speak anymore. Johnson and I would handle the formal presentations, but we'd still need him for the Q&A sessions. Hayes looked at me, blinked once. He understood. "I thought you were going to send me home," he said. "No," I said, "you need to be part of this." We continued to Chicago, then Dallas, then Houston, then San Francisco. We went on to Los Angeles, then Seattle. At each stop, we grew more tired, almost weepy with fatigue, Johnson and I especially. A strange sentimentality was stealing over us. On the airplanes in the hotel bars, we talked about our salad days, his endless letters. "Please send encouraging words," my maddening reticence. We talked about the name Nike coming to him in a dream. We talked about Stretch and Giampietro and the Marlboro Man and all the different times I jerked him back and forth across the country. We talked about the day he was almost strung up by his Exeter employees after their paychecks had bounced. "After all that," Johnson said one day in the back of a town car, headed to the next meeting, "and now we're the toasts of Wall Street." I looked at him. Things do change. But Johnson hadn't. He now reached into his bag, took out a book, and began to read. The roadshow ended the day before Thanksgiving. I vaguely remember a turkey, some cranberries, my family around me. I vaguely remember being aware that it was an anniversary of sorts. I'd first flown to Japan on Thanksgiving Day, 1962. Over dinner, my father had 1,000 questions about the public offering. My mother had none. She said she'd always known it would happen ever since the day she bought a pair of $8 Limber-Ups. They were understandably feeling reflective, congratulatory, but Penny and I quickly hushed them, begged them not to be premature. The game was still on. The race was afoot. We chose a date for the offering. December 2nd, 1980. The last remaining hurdle was settling on a price. The night before the offering, Hayes came into my office. "The guys at Kuhn Loeb are recommending $20 per share," he said. "Too low," I said. "It's insulting." "Well, it can't be too high," he cautioned. "We want the damn thing to sell." The whole process was crazy-making because it was imprecise. There was no right number. It was all a matter of opinion, feeling, and it was up to us to make our opinion, our feeling, the reality. Selling. That's what I'd been doing these last 18 years, and I was tired of it. I didn't want to sell anymore. In my heart, our stock was worth $22 a share. That was the number. We'd earned that number. We deserved to be on the high end of the price range. A company called Apple was also going public that same week and selling for $22 a share, and we were worth as much as them, I said to Hayes. If a bunch of Wall Street guys didn't see it that way, I was ready to walk away from the deal. I glared at Hayes. I knew what he was thinking. Here we go again. Pay Nisho first. The next morning, Hayes and I drove downtown to our law firm. A clerk showed us into the senior partner's office. A paralegal dialed Kuhn Loeb in New York, then clicked a button on a speaker in the middle of the big walnut desk. Hayes and I stared at the speaker. Disembodied voices filled the room. One of the voices grew louder, clearer. "Gentlemen, good morning." "Good morning," we said. The loud voice took the lead. It gave a long and careful explanation of Kuhn Loeb's reasoning on the stock price, which was jabberwocky. "And so," the voice said, "we can't go any higher than $21. "No," I said, "our number is 22. We heard the other voices murmuring. They came up to 21.50. "I'm afraid," said the loud voice, "that's our final offer. Gentlemen, 22 is our number." Hayes stared at me. I stared at the speaker. Cracking silence. We could hear heavy breaths, pops, scrapes, papers being shuffled. I closed my eyes and let all that white noise wash over me. I relived every negotiation in my life to that point. "So, Dad, you remember that crazy idea I had at Stanford?" Gentlemen, I represent Blue Ribbon Sports of Portland, Oregon.
You see, Dot, I love Penny, and Penny loves me, and if things continue in this vein, I see us building a life together.
I'm sorry, the loud voice said angrily. We'll have to call you back. Click.
We sat. We said nothing. I took long, deep breaths. The clerk's face slowly turned bright orange. 5 minutes passed. 15 minutes. Sweat ran down Hayes' forehead and neck. The phone rang. The clerk looked at us to make sure we were ready. We nodded. He pressed the button on the speaker.
Gentlemen, the voice said, we have a deal. We'll send it out to market this Friday.
I drove home. I remember the boys were outside playing. Penny was standing in the kitchen. How was your day? She said.
Okay. Good.
We got our prize.
She smiled. Of course you did.
I went for a long run. Then I took a hot, hot shower. Then I had a quick dinner. Then I tucked in the boys and gave them a story.
The year was 1773. Privates Matt Knight and Travis Knight were fighting under the command of General Washington. Cold, tired, hungry, their uniforms in tatters. They camped for the winter at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. They slept in log huts wedged between two mountains, Mount Joy and Mount Misery. Morning till night, bitter cold winds sliced through the mountains and barreled through the chinks in the huts. Food was scarce. Only a third of the men had shoes. Whenever they walked outside, they left bloody footprints in the snow. Thousands died, but Matt and Travis held on.
Finally, spring came. The troops got word that the British had retreated, and the French were coming to the aid of the colonists. Privates Matt and Travis knew from then on that they could live through anything. Mount Joy, Mount Misery.
Good night, boys.
Night, Dad.
I turned out the light and went and sat in front of the TV with Penny. Neither of us was really watching. She was reading a book and I was doing calculations in my head. By this time next week, Bowerman would be worth $9 million. Kale, $6.6 million. Woodell, Johnson, Hayes, Strasser, each about $6 million. Fantasy numbers. Numbers that meant nothing. I never knew that numbers could mean so much and so little at the same time.
Bed, Penny said. I nodded.
I went around the house, turning off lights, checking doors. Then I joined her. For a long time we lay in the dark. It wasn't over, far from it. The first part, I told myself, is behind us, but it's only the first part. I asked myself, what are you feeling? It wasn't joy. It wasn't relief. If I felt anything, it was regret. Good God, I thought, yes, regret. Because I honestly wished I could do it all over again. I fell asleep for a few hours. When I woke up, it was cold and rainy. I went to the window. The trees were dripping water. Everything was mist and fog. The world was the same as it had been the day before, as it had always been. Nothing had changed, least of all, me. And yet I was worth $178 million. I showered, ate breakfast, drove to work. I was at my desk before anyone else.
Night. We love going to the movies. We always have. But tonight we have a dilemma. We've seen all the violent movies, which Penny likes best. So we're going to have to venture outside our comfort zone, try something different. A comedy, maybe. I leaf through the paper. How about The Bucket List at the Century? Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman? She frowns. I guess. It's Christmas time, 2007. The Bucket List turns out to be anything but a comedy. It's a movie about mortality. Two men, Nicholson and Freeman, both terminally ill with cancer, decide to spend their remaining days doing all the fun things, the crazy things they've always wanted to do, to make the most of their time before they kick the bucket.
An hour into the movie, there's not a chuckle to be had. There are also many strange, unsettling parallels between the movie and my life. First, Nicholson always makes me think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which makes me think of Kesey, which takes me back to my days at the University of Oregon. Second, high on the bucket list of Nicholson's character is seeing the Himalayas, which makes me think of my time hiking the foothills in Nepal. Above all, Nicholson's character employs a personal assistant, a sort of surrogate son named Matthew. He even looks a bit like my son. Same scruffy goatee. When the movie ends, when the lights come up, Penny and I are both relieved to stand and return to the bright glare of real life. The theater is a new 16-screen colossus in the heart of Cathedral City, just outside Palm Springs. These days we spend much of the winter there, hiding from the chilly Oregon rains. Walking through the lobby, waiting for our eyes to adjust, we spot two familiar faces. At first we can't place them. We're still seeing Nicholson and Freeman in our minds. But these faces are equally familiar, equally famous. Now we realize it's Bill and Warren, Gates and Buffett. We stroll over. Neither man is what you'd call a close friend, but we've met them several times at social events and conferences. And we have common causes, common interests, a few mutual acquaintances. "Fancy meeting you here," I say. And I cringe. Did I really just say that? Is it possible I'm still shy and awkward in the presence of celebrities? "I was just thinking about you," one of them says. We shake hands all around and talk mostly about Palm Springs. "Isn't this place lovely? Isn't it wonderful to get out of the cold?" We talk about families, business, sports. I hear someone behind us whisper, "Hey, look, Buffett and Gates. Who's that other guy?" I smile, as it should be. In my head, I can't help doing some quick math. At the moment, I'm worth $10 billion, and each of these men is worth 5 or 6 times more. Lead me from the unreal to the real. Penny asks if they enjoyed the movie. "Yes," they both say, looking down at their shoes, though it was a bit depressing. "What's on your bucket lists?" I nearly ask, but I don't. Gates and Buffett seem to have done everything they've ever wanted in this life. They have no bucket list, surely. Which makes me ask myself, have I? At home, Penny picks up her needlepoint and I pour myself a glass of wine. I pull out a yellow legal pad to look at my notes and lists for tomorrow. For the first time in a while, it's blank. We sit in front of the 11 o'clock news, but my mind is far, far away. Drifting, floating, time traveling. A familiar feeling of late. I'm apt to spend long stretches of the day walking around in my childhood. For some reason, I think a lot about my grandfather, Bump Knight. He had nothing, less than nothing. And yet he managed to scrimp and save and buy a brand new Model T, in which he moved his wife and 5 kids from Winnebago, Minnesota, all the way to Colorado, then on to Oregon. He told me that he didn't bother to get his driver's license. He just up and went. Descending the Rockies in that rattling, shuddering piece of tin, he repeatedly scolded, "Whoa, whoa, you son of a bitch!" I heard this story so many times from him, and from aunts and uncles and cousins, I feel as though I was there. In a way, I guess, I was. Bump later bought a pickup, and he loved putting us grandkids in the back of it, driving us into town on errands. Along the way, he'd always stop by Sutherland Bakery and buy us a dozen glazed donuts, each. I need only look up at the blue sky or the blank white ceiling, and I'm there again, dangling my bare feet over his truck bed, feeling the fresh green wind on my face, licking glaze off a warm donut. Could I have risked as much, dared as much, walked the razor's edge of entrepreneurship between safety and catastrophe? Without the early foundation of that feeling, that bliss of safety and contentment? I don't think so. After 40 years, I've stepped down as Nike CEO, leaving the company in good hands, I think, and good shape, I trust. Sales last year, 2006, were $16 billion. Adidas was $10 billion, but who's counting? Our shoes and clothes are in 5,000 stores worldwide, and we have 10,000 employees. Our Chinese operation in Shanghai alone has 700. And China, our second largest market, is now our largest producer of shoes. I guess that 1980 trip paid off. The 5,000 employees at the world headquarters in Beaverton are housed on an Edenic collegiate campus with 200 acres of wooded wilderness, laced by rolling streams, dotted by pristine ball fields. The buildings are named after the men and women who have given us more than their names and endorsements. Joan Benoy Samuelson, Ken Griffey Jr., Mia Hamm, Tiger Woods, Dan Fouts, Jerry Rice, Steve Prefontaine. They've given us our identity and theirs. As chairman, I still go most days to my office. I look around at all those buildings, and I don't see buildings. I see temples. Any building is a temple, if you make it so. I think often of that momentous trip when I was 24. I think of myself standing high above Athens, gazing at the Parthenon, and I never fail to experience the sensation of time folding in on itself. Amid the campus buildings, along the campus walkways, there are enormous banners, action photos of the super athletes, the legends and giants and titans who've elevated Nike to something more than a brand. Jordan. Kobe. Tiger. Again, I can't help but think of my trip around the world. The River Jordan. Mystical Kobe, Japan. That first meeting at Onitsuka, pleading with the executives for the right to sell tigers. Can this all be a coincidence? I think of the countless Nike offices around the world. At each one, no matter the country, the phone number ends in 6453, which spells out Nike on the keypad. But, by pure chance, from right to left, it also spells out Pri's best time in the mile, to the tenth of a second. 3:54.6. I say by pure chance, but is it really? Am I allowed to think that some coincidences are more than coincidental? Can I be forgiven for thinking or hoping that the universe or some guiding demon has been nudging me, whispering to me, or else just playing with me? Can it really be nothing but a fluke of geography that the oldest shoes ever discovered are a pair of 9,000-year-old sandals salvaged from a cave in Oregon? Is there nothing to the fact that the sandals were discovered in 1938, the year I was born? I always feel a thrill, a shot of adrenaline, when I drive through the intersection of the campus's two main streets, each named after a Nike founding father. All day, every day, the security guard at the front gate gives visitors the same directions. What you want to do is take Bowerman Drive all the way up to Delhaize Way. I also take great pleasure in strolling past the oasis at the center of campus, the Nisho Iwai Japanese Gardens. In one sense, our campus is a topographical map of Nike's history and growth. In another, it's a diorama of my life. In yet another sense, it's a living, breathing expression of that vital human emotion, maybe the most vital of all, after love. Gratitude. The youngest employees at Nike seem to have it in abundance. They care deeply about the names on the streets and buildings and about the bygone days. Like Matthew begging for his bedtime story, they clamor for the old tales. They crowd the conference room whenever Woodell or Johnson visits. They've even formed a discussion group, an informal think tank, to preserve that original sense of innovation. They call themselves the Spirit of 72, which fills my heart. But it's not just the young people within the company who honor the history. I think back to July 2005. In the middle of some event, I can't recall which, LeBron James asks for a private word. Phil, can I see you a moment? Of course. When I first signed with you, he says, I didn't know all that much about the history of Nike, so I've been studying up. Oh? You're the founder. Well, co-founder, yes. It surprises a lot of people. and Nike was born in 1972. Well, born, yes, I suppose. Right. So I went to my jeweler and had them find a Rolex watch from 1972. He hands me the watch. It's engraved, "With thanks for taking a chance on me." As usual, I say nothing. I don't know what to say. It wasn't much of a chance. He was pretty close to a sure thing. But taking a chance on people, he's right. You could argue that's what it's all been about. I putter out to the kitchen, pour another glass of wine. Returning to my recliner, I watch Penny needlepoint for a while, and the mental images come tumbling faster and faster, as if I'm needlepointing memories. I watch Pete Sampras crush every opponent at one of his many Wimbledons. After the final point, he tosses his racket into the stands to me. He overshoots and hits the man behind me, who sues, of course. I see Pete's arch-rival, Andre Agassi, win the U.S. Open unseeded and come to my box after the final shot in tears. We did it, Phil. We? I smile as Tiger drains the final putt at Augusta, or is it St. Andrews? He hugs me and holds on for many seconds longer than I expect. I roll my mind back over the many private, intimate moments I've shared with him and with Bo Jackson and with Michael Jordan. Staying at Michael's house in Chicago, I pick up the phone next to the bed in the guest room and discover that there's a voice on the line. May I help you? It's room service. Genuine, round-the-clock, whatever-your-heart-desires room service. I set down the phone, my mouth hanging open. They're all like sons and brothers, family, no less. When Tiger's father, Earl, dies, the church in Kansas holds fewer than 100, and I'm honored to be included. When Jordan's father is murdered, I fly to North Carolina for the funeral and discover with a shock that a seat is reserved for me in the front row. All of which leads me back, of course, to Matthew. I think of his long, difficult search for meaning, for identity, for me. His search often looked so familiar, even though Matthew didn't have my luck or my focus, nor my insecurity. Maybe if he'd had a little more insecurity. In his quest to find himself, he dropped out of college. He experimented, dabbled, rebelled, argued, ran away. Nothing worked. Then at last, in 2000, he seemed to enjoy being a husband, a father, a philanthropist. He got involved in Mi Casa Su Casa, a charity building and orphanage in El Salvador. On one of his visits there, after a few days of hard, satisfying work, he took a break. He drove with two friends to Ilopango, a deep water lake, to go scuba diving. For some reason, he decided to see how deep he could go. He decided to take a risk that even his risk-addicted father would never take. Something went wrong. At 150 feet, my son lost consciousness. If I were to think about Matthew in his final moments, fighting for air, I believe my imagination could get me very close to how he must have felt. After the thousands of miles I've logged as a runner, I know that feeling of fighting for that next breath. But I won't let my imagination go there, ever. Still, I've talked to the two friends who were with him. I've read everything I've been able to get my hands on about diving accidents. When things go wrong, I've learned, a diver often feels something called the Martini effect. He thinks everything is okay, better than okay. He feels euphoric. That must have happened to Matthew, I tell myself. Because at the last second, he pulled out his mouthpiece. I choose to believe this euphoria scenario, to believe that my son didn't suffer at the end, that my son was happy. I choose, because it's the only way I can go on. Penny and I were at the movies when we found out. We'd gone to the 5 o'clock showing of Shrek 2. In the middle of the movie, we turned and saw Travis standing in the aisle. Travis. He was whispering to us in the dark, "You guys need to come with me." We walked up the aisle out of the theater from darkness to light. As we emerged, he said, "I just got a phone call from El Salvador." Penny fell to the floor. Travis helped her up. He put his arm around his mother, and I staggered away to the end of the hallway, tears streaming. I recall seven strange, unbidden words running through my head over and over, like a fragment of some poem. "So this is the way it ends." By the next morning, the news was everywhere. Internet, radio, newspapers, TV, all blaring the bare facts. Penny and I pulled the blinds, locked the doors, cut ourselves off. But not before our niece Brittany moved in with us. To this day, I believe that she saved our lives. Every Nike athlete wrote, emailed, phoned, every single one. But the first was Tiger. His call came in at 7:30 a.m. I will never, ever forget. And I will not stand for a bad word spoken about Tiger in my presence. Another early caller was Alberto Salazar, the ferociously competitive distance runner who won three straight New York City marathons in Nikes. I will always love him for many things, but above all for that show of concern. He's a coach now, and recently he brought a few of his runners to Beaverton. They were having a light workout in the middle of Ronaldo Field when someone turned and saw Alberto on the ground, gasping for air, a heart attack. He was legally dead for 14 minutes until paramedics revived him and rushed him to St. Vincent's. I know that hospital well. My son Travis was born there. My mother died there 27 years after my father. In his final 6 months, I was able to take my father on a long trip to put to rest the eternal question of whether he was proud, to show him that I was proud of him. We went around the world, saw Nikes in every country we visited, and with every appearance of a swoosh, his eyes shone. The pain of his irritation, his hostility to my dream, it had faded. It was long gone. But not the memory. Fathers and sons, it's always been the same since the dawn of time. My dad, Arnold Palmer, once confided to me at the Masters, did all he could to discourage me from being a professional golfer. I smiled. You don't say. Visiting Alberto, walking into the lobby of St. Vincent's, I was overcome with visions of both my parents. I felt them at my elbow, at my ear. Theirs was a strained relationship, I believe. But, as with an iceberg, everything was below the surface. In their house on Claiborne Street, the tension was concealed, and calm and reason almost always prevailed because of their love for us. Love wasn't spoken or shown, but it was there, always. My sisters and I grew up knowing that both parents, different as they were from each other and from us, cared. That's their legacy. That's their lasting victory. I walked to the cardiac unit, saw the familiar sign on the door, no admittance. I sailed past the sign, through the door, down the hall, and found Alberto's room. He lifted his head off the pillow, managed a pained smile. I patted his arm and we had a good talk. Then I saw that he was fading. "See you soon," I said. His hand shot out and grabbed mine. "If something happens to me," he said, "promise me you'll take care of Galen." His athlete, the one he'd been training, who was just like a son to him. I got it. Oh, how I got it. "Of course," I said, "of course. Galen, consider it done." I walked out of the room, barely hearing the beeping machines, the laughing nurses, the patient groaning down the hall. I thought of that phrase, "It's just business." It's never just business. It never will be. If it ever does become just business, that will mean that business is very bad. "Time for bed," Penny says, packing up her needlepoint. "Yes," I tell her, "I'll be along in a minute." I keep thinking of one line in the bucket list. "You measure yourself by the people who measure themselves by you." I forget if it was Nicholson or Freeman. The line is so true, so very true. And it transports me to Tokyo, to the offices of Nisho. I was there not long ago for a visit. The phone rang. "For you," the Japanese receptionist said, extending the receiver. "Me?" It was Michael Johnson, the 3-time gold medalist, holder of the world record in the 200 meters and 400 meters. He did it all in our shoes. He happened to be in Tokyo, he said, and heard I was too. "Do you want to have dinner?" he asked. I was flattered, but I told him I couldn't. Nisha was having a banquet for me. I invited him to come. Hours later, we were sitting together on the floor before a table covered with shabu-shabu, toasting each other with cup after cup of sake. We laughed, cheered, clinked glasses, and something passed between us. The same thing that passes between me and most of the athletes I work with. A transference, a camaraderie, a sort of connection. It's brief, but it nearly always happens. And I know it's part of what I was searching for when I went around the world in 1962. To study the self is to forget the self. Mikasa Tsukasa. Oneness. In some way, shape, or form, it's what every person I've ever met has been seeking. I think of others who didn't make it this far. Bowerman died on Christmas Eve, 1999, in Fossil. He'd gone back to his hometown, as we always suspected he would. He still owned his house on the mountaintop above campus, but he chose to quit it, to move with Mrs. Bowerman to a Fossil retirement home. He needed to be where he started. Did he tell someone that? Or am I imagining him muttering it to himself? I remember when I was a sophomore, we had a dual meet with Washington State and Pullman, and Bowerman made the bus driver go through Fossil so he could show us. I immediately thought of that sentimental detour when I heard that he'd lain down on the bed and never got up. It was Jaquo who phoned. I was reading the paper, the Christmas tree blinking, blinking, blinking. You always remember the strangest details from such moments. I choked into the phone. "I'll have to call you back," then walked upstairs to my den. I turned out all the lights. Eyes shut, I replayed a million different moments, including that long-ago lunch at the Cosmopolitan Hotel. Deal? Deal. An hour passed before I could go back downstairs. At some point that night, I gave up the Kleenex and just draped a towel over my shoulder, a move I learned from another beloved coach, John Thompson. Strasser passed suddenly, too. Heart attack, 1993. He was so young, it was a tragedy, all the more so because it came after we'd had a falling out. Strasser had been instrumental in signing Jordan, in building up the Jordan brand and wrapping it around Rudy's air soles. Air Jordan changed Nike, took us to the next level, and the next. But it changed Strasser, too. He felt that he should no longer be taking orders from anyone, including me, especially me. We clashed too many times, and he quit. It might have been okay if he'd just quit, but he went to work for Adidas. An intolerable betrayal. I never forgave him. Though I did recently, happily, proudly, hire his daughter Avery. 22 years old, she works in special events, and she's said to be thriving. It's a blessing and a joy to see her name in the company directory. I wish Strasser and I had patched things up before he died, but I don't know that it was possible. We were both born to compete, and we were both bad at forgiving. For both of us, betrayal was extra potent kryptonite. I felt that same sense of betrayal when Nike came under attack for conditions in our overseas factories, the so-called sweatshop controversy. Whenever reporters said a factory was unsatisfactory, they never said how much better it was than the day we first went in. They never said how hard we'd worked with our factory partners to upgrade conditions, to make them safer and cleaner. They never said these factories weren't ours, that we were renters, one among many tenants. They simply searched until they found a worker with complaints about conditions, and they used that worker to vilify us, and only us, knowing our name would generate maximum publicity. Of course, my handling of the crisis only made it worse. Angry, hurt, I often reacted with self-righteousness, petulance, anger. On some level, I knew my reaction was toxic, counterproductive, but I couldn't stop myself. It's just not easy to remain cool and even-keeled when you wake up one day thinking you're creating jobs and helping poor countries modernize and enabling athletes to achieve greatness, only to find yourself being burned in effigy outside the flagship retail store in your own hometown. The company reacted as I did, emotionally. Everyone was reeling. Many late nights in Beaverton, you'd find all the lights on and soul-searching conversations taking place in various conference rooms and offices. Though we knew that much of the criticism was unjust, that Nike was a symbol, a scapegoat more than the true culprit, all of that was beside the point. We had to admit, we could do better. We told ourselves, we must do better. Then we told the world, just watch. We'll make our factories shining examples. And we did. In the 10 years since the bad headlines and lurid exposés, we've used the crisis to reinvent the entire company. For instance, one of the worst things about a shoe factory used to be the rubber room, where uppers and soles are bonded. The fumes are choking, toxic, cancer-causing. So we invented a water-based bonding agent that gives off no fumes, thereby eliminating 97% of the carcinogens in the air. Then we gave this invention to our competitors, handed it over to anyone who wanted it. They all did. Nearly all of them now use it. One of many, many examples. We've gone from a target of reformers to a dominant player in the factory reform movement. Today, the factories that make our products are among the best in the world. An official at the United Nations recently said so. Nike is the gold standard by which we measure all apparel factories. Out of the sweatshop crisis also came the girl effect, a massive Nike effort to break the generational cycles of poverty in the bleakest corners of the world. Along with the United Nations and other corporate and government partners, the Girl Effect is spending tens of millions of dollars in a smart, tough global campaign to educate and connect and lift up young girls. Economists, sociologists, not to mention our own hearts, tell us that in many societies, young girls are the most economically vulnerable and vital demographic. So helping them helps all. Whether striving to end child marriage in Ethiopia, or building safe spaces for teenage girls in Nigeria, or launching a magazine and radio show that deliver powerful, inspiring messages to young Rwandans, the Girl Effect is changing millions of lives. And the best days of my week, month, year, are those when I receive the glowing reports from its front lines. I'd do anything to go back, to make so many different decisions, which might or might not have averted the sweatshop crisis. But I can't deny that the crisis has led to miraculous change inside and outside Nike. For that, I must be grateful. Of course, there will always be the question of wages. The salary of a third world factory worker seems impossibly low to Americans, and I understand. Still, we have to operate within the limits and structures of each country, each economy. We can't simply pay whatever we wish to pay. In one country, which shall be nameless, when we tried to raise wages, we found ourselves called on the carpet, summoned to the office of a top government official and ordered to stop. We were disrupting the nation's entire economic system, he said. It's simply not right, he insisted, or feasible, that a shoe worker makes more than a medical doctor. Change never comes as fast as we want it. I think constantly of the poverty I saw while traveling the world in the 1960s. I knew then that the only answer to such poverty is entry-level jobs, lots of them. I didn't form this theory on my own. I heard it from every economics professor I ever had, at both Oregon and Stanford, and everything I saw and read thereafter backed it up. International trade always benefits both trading nations.
Another thing I often heard from those same professors was the old maxim, when goods don't pass international borders, soldiers will. Though I've been known to call business war without bullets, it's actually a wonderful bulwark against